Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are we're putting away the keyboard, closing the laptop lid, and picking up the soldering iron.
Yes, we are.
We're looking at a project that sits right at this really cool intersection of open source computing and tangible physical musical performance. I mean, we are talking about the Xynthian.
The Xynthian.
Yeah.
It's a really fascinating project because it's an attempt to solve a very specific modern problem.
Right.
Which is, how do you take a Raspberry Pi,
mm-hmm.
which is, for all intents and purposes, you know, just a tiny credit card-sized computer, mm-hmm. and give it the soul and the feel of a classic hardware synthesizer?
Exactly, because anyone can run synth software on a laptop. You can download a VST, click a mouse, make some noise.
Yeah, but clicking a mouse to turn a virtual filter knob feels...
It's sterile.
Completely.
It totally lacks connection. You can't perform a mouse click. And the Xynthian project is about taking that Pi, putting it in a box, and giving it physical, tactile controls.
Wow, wait.
Knobs, buttons, a real screen.
It's about building an instrument.
Right. Building an instrument. And to get there, to actually build that interface, well, that's our mission today. We are unpacking exactly how you, the user, take this stack of disparate sources and turn them into a working control surface.
So we really do have a stack of sources today.
Oh, yeah, a big one. We've pulled from the official Xynthian wiki, specifically the sections on adding encoders and web configuration.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some incredibly detailed troubleshooting threads from the discourse forums involving community legends like Wailu and Raban.
Real deep cuts.
Yeah, plus a really honest build log from a blogger named Kevin at Simple DIY Electronic Music Projects, and the actual technical white papers on Raspberry Pi audio architecture.
So we have the parts, we have the manuals, and we definitely have the community drama.
You really do. Let's start with the star of the show, the hardware component that actually bridges the gap between the human hand and the digital code, the rotary encoder.
It is the absolute heart of the Xynthian interface.
Mm.
But we need to make a very clear technical distinction right away here. Because, to the naked eye, a rotary encoder looks exactly like a volume knob on an old stereo.
Right. If you grab it and twist it, it feels like a knob. It has weight. It rotates. But in the documentation, they are so adamant about this. Do not confuse an encoder with a potentiometer.
Never.
Why is that distinction so critical for a synthesizer specifically?
It comes down to the difference between absolute positioning and relative positioning. A potentiometer, what we think of as a standard volume knob, is an analog device with physical stops.
Correct.
You turn it all the way to the left, it hits a wall at 0. You turn it to the right, it hits a wall at 10. It has an absolute position in the physical world that corresponds to a very specific voltage.
Which works totally fine for a stereo where volume is just a static thing.
Yeah.
But a Xynthian is, it's a chameleon. It changes its entire identity every time you load a new patch.
Precisely. Imagine you were playing a soft, mellow electric piano patch where the volume is set to 50%. Your physical knob is pointing straight up at 12 o'clock. Then you load a snapshot, that's Xynthian speak, for a preset, for a screaming lead synth where the volume was saved at 100%.
So the software knows the volume is 100%, but your physical knob is still sitting there pointing at 50%.
Exactly. And this creates what they call the jump problem.
Oh, right.
If you were using a standard potentiometer, the moment you touch that knob to make a tiny adjustment, the value would instantly snap or jump from 100% down to 50% just to match the physical knob.
Wow, so it ruins the performance. It just completely glitches the audio.
It breaks the immersion completely. It reminds you that you're just controlling a computer that's suddenly confused.
And encoders solve this because they are endless. They spin 360 degrees forever. There are no stops.
Right. They don't tell the software, I am at position 5. They simply send a digital pulse that says, I moved one step clockwise, or I moved one step counterclockwise.
So they're purely relative. The software holds the truth of the value, and the knob just suggests a direction.
Exactly. That allows the Xynthian to swap instruments instantly, change pages, and reconfigure itself without the hardware ever fighting the software.
And they are multifunctional, too. The encoders used in the Xynthian builds usually have a built-in push switch, like you can press the shaft down like a button.
Yeah, and the wiki breaks this down into 3 distinct interactions, which is great. You have a short press, a bold press, and a long press.
I love that they codified that. It isn't just a convenience. It seems like it effectively replaces the computer mouse entirely.
It has to. The goal is a performing interface. A short press might select an item. A bold press, which is slightly longer, is often hard-coded to back or layer functions.
And a long press.
That might bring up the admin menu. It turns four simple knobs into a really deep navigation system. You can bend a filter, select a new sound, and navigate menus without ever looking at a cursor or touching a keyboard.
That's the dream. But getting these magical knobs to actually talk to the Raspberry Pi, that is where the reality of DIY sets in.
Oh, for sure.
Looking at our sources, there seem to be two philosophical schools of thought on how to wire these things up.
There definitely are. You have the official or efficient path, and what the wiki delightfully calls the nefarious path.
I love that they call it nefarious. It sounds like you're breaking the law by wiring it wrong. Let's start with the official method first. This involves adding an extra chip to the mix, specifically the MCP23017.
Right.
But why add more silicon if the Pi already has input pins?
It's all about resource management. The Raspberry Pi has a set of GPIO pins, general purpose input output, but there are only 40 of them on the header.
Which sounds like a lot until you start plugging things in.
Exactly. And crucially, many of those pins are reserved for specific things like high quality audio, power, or other communication protocols.
Mm-hmm.
If you wire four encoders plus their switches directly to the Pi, you are eating up 12 to 15 pins immediately.
It's inefficient. You're clogging the highway with traffic that could be handled elsewhere.
Right. The MCP23017 is an I/O expander. Think of it as a middleman or a sub-manager. It talks to the Raspberry Pi using a protocol called I2C.
Okay.
And the beauty of I2C is that it only requires two signal wires, data and clock plus power and ground.
Let me get this straight. You do all your messy, complex soldering to this cheap little expander chip and then run just two clean wires back to the main computer.
Exactly. It completely offloads the pin usage, and it simplifies the software addressing too.
How so?
Well, if you look at the Xynthian web configuration tool, using this chip changes how the system sees the controls. The pin numbering standardizes start at 100.
Mm-hmm.
Encoder A is 100, encoder B is 101.
Clean.
It's very clean, it's standard, and it's robust.
And this is what the official Synaptic module uses, right? It's the gold standard.
Yes.
But then we have the nefarious path. Direct GPIO wiring. Why would anyone choose the messy way if the chip is so much better?
Because it feels accessible. If you are a hobbyist with a Pi and a bag of encoders you bought off Amazon, you look at the board and say, I have empty pins right here, I have wires here, why wait for a chip to arrive in the mail? So you wire the encoder legs directly to the Pi's header.
But the wiki actively warns us about this. They call it a cabling mess.
It creates an absolute rat's nest inside the case. We saw threads on the forum where users closed the case and the pressure physically severed a connection or shorted two wires together.
Oh, man.
But the real nightmare, the thing that drives people to the forums in tears, is the numbering chaos.
I fell down such a rabbit hole reading about this. It seems there are four different languages for naming the exact same pin on a Raspberry Pi. It feels like the Tower of Babel.
It is the absolute bane of every beginner. First, you have the physical pin number, literally counting 1 to 40 on the board.
That seems easy enough.
It is. But the computer doesn't care about physical location. It cares about the processor connection. So you have the BCM number, which is how the Broadcom processor addresses it.
And I'm guessing those don't match?
Rarely. Physical pin 12 is BCM 18.
Of course it is.
But wait, there's more. Then you have wiring Pi numbers, which is a legacy software library that uses its own completely arbitrary numbering system. So physical pin 12, which is DCM 18, is wiring Pi 1.
That is maddening. So if the configuration tool asks for the pin number, and you type 12 because that's where you plugged it in, but the software expects the BCM number?
Nothing works. The knob is dead.
Wow.
The forum user, Wailu, who appears to be a major figure in the community, actually created custom charts just to map these translations because people were getting it wrong so often.
He calls the process involved.
Which I think is a very polite British way of saying incredibly frustrating.
Very diplomatic. It's a translation layer that trips everyone up. And speaking of tripping up, there is another invisible enemy in direct wiring that kept coming up in the sources.
Bounce. Ah, yes.
Right.
D-douncing. This is a physics problem, not a software one.
Explain that.
When you press a mechanical switch or turn a mechanical encoder, you are slamming two pieces of metal together to close a circuit. To us, it feels like one solid click. But at a microscopic level, those metal contacts vibrate. They bounce apart and reconnect.
So it's like dropping a ping pong ball. It doesn't just hit the floor and stay. It bounces a few times before settling.
Exactly. But to a computer, which checks the signal thousands of times a second, that bounce looks like on, off, on, off, on, off. You think you click down once, but the computer registers 50 clicks instantly.
And your menu scrolls to the bottom of the list in a blur.
Exactly. It makes the instrument feel broken or possessed.
How do you fix that? Is it a software fix or a hardware fix?
Well, you can do it in software, telling the code to ignore signals for a few milliseconds after the first one. But the Xynthian sources strongly recommend a hardware solution. Capacitors.
Right. The wiki recommends a 100 nanofarad capacitor across the switch pins.
Right. Think of the capacitor like a tiny water reservoir or a shock absorber. When the signal bounces, the capacitor absorbs those jagged spikes and releases a smooth, clean curve. It turns a messy electrical storm into a clear on or off signal.
I liked the phrasing in the wiki. It said these capacitors are not critical, but convenient.
Which, in the context of building a musical instrument, is polite engineer speak for, if you want a professional feeling device that actually works on stage, install them.
Install the capacitors, people.
Yeah.
So we have our theory. We know about encoders, expander chips, and capacitors. But the reality of the workbench is usually different. We found a great blog post from a builder named Kevin at Simple DIY Electronic Music Projects who documented his actual build process.
Kevin's log is so valuable because he admits his mistakes.
Yeah.
He decided to build a custom I/O board. He prototyped it, laid it out on a PCB, soldered it, and then realized he had swapped the voltage and ground pins for his specific encoders.
That is the classic check twice, solder once failure. Did he scrap the whole board?
No, and this is the true spirit of the project. He lived with it. He just modified his wiring harness to cross the cables over. It wasn't pretty, but it worked. However, he made another mistake that was a bit more critical.
What was that?
He wired his audio link, the I2S connection to GPIO4, instead of GPIO 18.
Oh, and unlike power, you can't just swap those cables. The Pi looks for audio on very specific pins.
Exactly. It highlights that even if you are an experienced builder, the pinout complexity bites you. Mm-hmm. He really emphasized the importance of prototyping on a breadboard, those temporary plastic boards where you plug wires in before you ever touch the solder.
Good advice. We saw a similar detective story in the forum with a user named Sir Blackmore. He wired everything up and posted, "I can push the switch, but turning the knob does nothing."
That is a terrifying moment. You think you have broken hardware.
It's the worst.
But the community response was fantastic. Wailu jumped in and suggested a command line tool called GPIO Readall.
I love this tool. It sounds like X-ray vision for the Pi.
It essentially is. You open the terminal, type GPIO Readall, and it gives you a real-time matrix of every pin on the board. You can see the logic state, 0 or 1.
So you turn the knob physically, and you literally watch the screen to see if the zeros flip to ones.
Right. In Sir Blackmore's case, he was turning the knob, and the numbers weren't changing. That told him immediately, the software is fine, the config is fine, the signal is simply not reaching the chip.
And it turned out to be swapped wires again.
It's almost always wiring. But without that diagnostic tool, you are just guessing in the dark. This reinforces the other golden rule that appears constantly in the sources. Make notes.
Yes. The documentation literally says you will forget how you wired it when you open the box 6 months later.
It's inevitable. You build it, you play it, something breaks a year later. You open it up, and it looks like a bomb defusal scene. If you didn't write down blue wire goes to GPIO 14, you are starting from scratch.
Okay, so once the physical battle is one wire's connected, capacitor's debouncing, you have to tell the brain of the operation what you did. This brings us to the web configuration tool.
Right, Xynthian is unique because you don't generally write code to set it up. You go to a web browser on your laptop, type xynthian.local, and you get a dashboard.
If you bought the official kit, this is easy. You select V5 kit and you're done. But for our DIY heroes like Kevin and Sir Blackmore,
they select custom and then they face the grid. You have to manually map those pins we talked about. Encoder A is on pin X, encoder B is on pin Y.
And this is where the I/O expander chip complicates things slightly again. If you use the chip, the MCP23017, you have to configure something called interrupts. Can you explain that concept?
Sure. It's about efficiency again.
Yeah.
The Raspberry Pi has a lot to do. It's generating sound, running the display. It doesn't want to constantly ask the expander chip, did he touch the knob? Did he touch the knob? How about now?
Like a kid asking, are we there yet? Repeatedly in the backseat.
Exactly. That's called polling, and it wastes CPU cycles. Mm-hmm. An interrupt is like a doorbell. The expander chip sits there quietly watching the encoders. When you turn a knob, the chip rings the doorbell on the Pi via a dedicated interrupt pin, usually INTA or INTB.
Got it.
The Pi wakes up, handles the change, and goes back to work processing audio.
So in the webconf, you have to tell the Pi where the doorbell is wired.
Precisely. It's a small detail, but if you miss it, your knobs will feel sluggish or totally unresponsive because the Pi isn't hearing the doorbell ring.
Now, we have been talking about these four encoders as the standard interface, but browsing the feature requests section of the forum, we found some users who are definitely not satisfied with just four knobs.
Ah, the advanced ambitions. This brings us to a really interesting thread started by a user named Pastitas.
Pastitas wanted more. He wanted a full controller grid.
Right. The standard Xynthian screen shows four parameters at a time: filter, resonance, attack, decay. To get to the LFO speed, you have to click next page. Pastitas wanted a grid of 64 parameters, all accessible at once, controlled by an external MIDI controller, like a Korg Nano control.
He called it the Xyntherface, which is a great name.
It's a great concept.
Yeah.
But it highlights a real tension in the community. You have people who just want to build the kit and play, and then you have people who want to fundamentally rewrite the user interface to suit their specific performance needs.
And Ribbon, another very experienced developer on the forums, stepped in to mentor him. But he gave a specific warning about dissident UI.
That was such a fascinating phrase. Ribbon advised against looking at the step sequencer code as a template because it was dissident UI.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning it didn't follow the standard rules of the rest of the operating system. He was effectively saying, if you want to build this grid, build it on the stable foundations, not the experimental outliers.
It's solid engineering advice, but I also have to mention the tone of that thread. It wasn't just dry technical support.
Oh, no, it was hilarious. The community really demands proof of life. At one point, Wailu threatens that if users don't post sound samples of their builds, Ribbon will come around with a flock of killer ravens and an unfeasibly large cricket bat.
It paints such a vivid picture. These aren't just tech support agents. They are a group of eccentrics who are passionate about making noise. They want to hear what you made.
And that passion is what drives the project forward. But ultimately, all this wiring and coding is for one single purpose: audio. We need to hear the thing.
Right. The Raspberry Pi white paper we looked at breaks down the output options, and there are some serious traps here, especially for newer hardware.
The biggest trap by far is the analog jack. On the Raspberry Pi 3 and 4, there's a headphone jack right on the board. It is so tempting to just plug in there and start playing.
But the white paper says do not do it.
It's technically PWM audio, pulse width modulation.
Yeah.
It's faking an analog signal using digital pulses. It is noisy, it has a high noise floor, and it lacks dynamic range.
It sounds bad.
It sounds crunchy.
Yeah.
And not in a good distortion pedal kind of way. It is fine for checking does this work, but for a musical instrument, it is completely unacceptable.
And if you have the new Raspberry Pi 5...
you don't even have the option. They removed the jack entirely to save board space.
So what is the professional solution to actually get good sound out of this thing?
You need an I2S HAT.
Break that down. IHAT stands for hardware attached on top.
Right. It's a circuit board that plugs directly onto the 40-pin header. Brands like HiFiBerry, or the official Synaptic audio module, they use the I2S standard, which is a pure digital audio stream.
All right.
The IHAT does the digital to analog conversion, the DC on its own high-quality hardware, completely bypassing the Pi's noisy internal audio circuitry.
That's the gold standard. But Kevin's blog mentioned a third path, which was USB.
Yes. The Raspberry Pi OS is surprisingly good with USB class compliant devices. If you have a Focusrite or a Behringer audio interface that you use for recording on your PC, you can likely just plug it straight into the Xynthian's USB port.
That seems like the easiest win if you already have the gear. What about Bluetooth? We all live wirelessly now. Why not just use a Bluetooth speaker?
The white paper is very, very clear. Avoid it for performance. Bluetooth has latency.
The delay.
Exactly. You press a key, and 200 milliseconds later, you hear the sound.
Yeah.
For listening to a deep dive, that's fine. For playing a piano solo, it is impossible. It destroys the feedback loop between your hand and your ear.
So wired it up with a HAT or use a solid USB interface.
Correct.
You know, stepping back and looking at this whole process, the soldering of capacitors to fix physics problems, the decoding of pin maps, the command line detective work, it is objectively a lot of effort. You could just go buy a synthesizer.
You definitely could. But the Xynthian offers something a Korg or a Yamaha doesn't.
What is that?
Ownership. There's a quote from the wiki about the goal being subtle parameter control. When you reach out and twist a filter knob on a Xynthian and you hear the sound warp, there's a very specific satisfaction in knowing you wired that connection.
Yeah.
You debated the pin out. You fix the bounce.
It transforms the device from a consumer product into a deeply personal instrument.
Exactly. It has soul, Not because of the code, but because of the labor you put into it.
But here's the thought I want to leave you with. We spent all this time discussing the critical importance of hardware knobs, but we also saw Pastitas trying to build a controller grid on a touchscreen to map 64 parameters at once using software.
It's the tension at the heart of the future of music tech.
Right. As screens get better and haptics get better, do we actually need the soldering iron? At what point does the software interface become so good that the physical knob becomes obsolete?
I think as long as humans have fingers, we will want something to grab. But it is a blurry line.
Well, if you are currently staring at a pile of wires and a blank PCB, wondering if you should have just used a touchscreen, check your pinout charts one last time.
And make notes.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.